First Development will be in order. Today's date is Tuesday, March 12th, and I have been pausing in hopes that our fellow committee members would come, because I hate to have President Kaler begin without, having everyone have the benefit of your comments and presentation. So while I stalled for just a couple minutes, I would ask all of the regents who are in the audience to stand up so we can recognize you. So thank you for joining us here today, and it's particularly nice to see our newest regent, Abdul Amari, and of course, all of you, truly. So thank you for being here, and thank you to all of the university staff and members who have come to hear this presentation. So, all right, President Kaler, I try and tell the members that I really would prefer everybody come on time if they can, but I'm a stickler, so I would have really started at 3, so.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sure duties elsewhere are heavy.
Well, to that point, President Kaler, this is committee deadline week, and so everybody is just crazy trying to get their bills heard, because committee first deadline is Friday and the second deadline the next Friday. So
it is a busy time.
Yes.
But thank you for having me. My name is Eric Kaler. It's my privilege to serve as the president of the University of Minnesota. And I, too, acknowledge the presence of Regent Cohen, Chair Regent Cohen, Regent Beeson, Devine, Frobenius, and McMillan. I greatly appreciate their support, and our newest Regent, Omari. On September 22, 2011, the day of my inauguration as the university's 16th president, I said these words. I said, driving excellence in our mission activities is not enough. We must also be excellent in our operations. In every aspect of university operations, we need to question what we do. We need to know if it has the intended outcome or if we could do it better or not at all. And I added, this institution needs to have an administrative backbone that is effective in supporting the teaching, research, and public engagement missions of the university. And since then, I have repeatedly emphasized operational excellence as one of my top priorities. Through this work, we are linking the efficiency and effectiveness of our business operations to the excellence and accessibility of our university. Over the past 18 months, I have convened 60 operational excellence meetings with my senior leadership team. And I want today to show you why and how we do this work, and to share with you the success stories, challenges, and the next steps. And I'm very pleased to present to you also our progress report on administrative structure analysis and key cost benchmarking at the University of Minnesota. As you requested, this report includes an initial analysis of our management structure, that is, of our spans of controls and organizational layers, and also our plan to benchmark our costs and operations against peer institutions. So the report really must be viewed in the context of all the operational excellence work that we have undertaken. I apologize for the lack of excellence of our projection device here, but you all have paper copies that feature the full script, and I encourage you to follow with those. What is operational excellence? First and foremost, to mitigate the impact of state budget reductions and to keep a lid on tuition, operational excellence is a long-term commitment to work smarter, reduce costs, enhance services, and increase revenues throughout the university. And it is using our resources, people, money, time, facilities, to the highest possible purpose. It's not just about saving money, although that's an important part. As importantly, it's also about getting more out of our limited resources, and it's about realizing a better way of doing things, and it is about change. Why are we doing this? Why operational excellence? Because as the state disinvests, as our students and families pay more tuition, and as research dollars become scarcer, we need to reduce our administrative costs so we can redirect resources to what's most important, teaching, research, and public engagement. How are we doing this? In every way we can, small and large, from our ambitious enterprise system upgrade program to a reduction in cell phone subsidies for employees, to voicemail efficiency, to IT reorganization, to risk recalibration, to changes in procurement, to the closing of administrative offices, to the tightening of reporting lines, we are becoming more and more operationally excellent. So let me tell you about our approach and how we set priorities and measured progress. I'll even share some success stories. I convened the first meeting of our operational excellence group of senior leaders and senior staff on September 6, 2011. That was the first day of the first week of the first semester of the first year of my presidency. It's a priority of mine. And I walked into the room with reports in hand from the consulting group Bain & Company and my experience working with that company at Stony Brook. I asked the group if we should pursue a similar engagement here. At a minimum, I suggested we review the Bain recommendations and track them against U of M operations. I also mentioned the words spans and layers for the first time, suggesting we complete an analysis of how many layers of management we had and how many employees report to each manager. Long before your request, this has been a priority of mine. Quickly, I got a thoughtful, educated earful from my senior leaders. I was told, Mr. President, we've already done many of the things in these studies, and for many functions, we've completed similar analyses. We have a number of reports on shelves, and they include recommendations that have not yet been implemented. Yet, some leaders argued that only by using a third-party expert would our work be credible to the broader public. Others were concerned about spending hundreds of thousands of dollars for a consultant when we had both external and internally generated reports still at our fingertips to implement. Ultimately, we decided to work through those existing reports as a first step. We established guiding principles to set priorities. We want to achieve administrative cost reductions and/or productivity improvements. We want to reduce redundancy and duplication. We want to promote entrepreneurialism, seize opportunities, and enhance organizational flexibility and adaptability. And we want to, and we are already, recalibrating the university's risk profile to achieve greater efficiencies while enhancing service. As ideas came forward, we reviewed recommendations already developed, and we asked whether they achieved these goals. Meanwhile, as we implement operational excellence, we want to do it in a way that does several things. First, that manages the operational and cultural aspects of change, adopts and shares best practices across the university, develops core competencies across the organization, encouraging the breakdown of silos, adopts sustainable, replicable business models, and develops qualitative and quantitative measures of effectiveness. With those principles in mind, from December 11 to December 11, we examined the reports produced in the previous 6 years. And in recent years, the university has done a lot. It closed and merged colleges, implemented an enterprise-wide energy reduction program, implemented purchasing initiatives, and improved processes in many functional areas. That was the good news. The bad news was there was not a lot of low-hanging fruit left to pick. And that meant moving you to the next level of operational excellence would require more data, thoughtful analysis, consultation, and tougher decisions. And unfortunately, it would probably take longer. So our first action was to review our priorities. We held listening sessions to gather input about making change from frontline operations managers. We learned that the university is too risk-averse and too regulatory, too mired in saying no rather than finding ways to say yes.
Excuse me, President
Taylor.
Yes, sir. Not sir. The launched risk recalibration effort, I don't know what that means. And is that the same thing as what you're speaking about with regard to your risk culture?
Yes, Madam Chair, it is. And let me illustrate this briefly. We could have a situation in which it was necessary for one of our extension agents to rent a ballroom space at a hotel in Greater Minnesota. We would engage in a complicated and lengthy legal arrangement with that hotel in case, oh my goodness, something bad happened to somebody while we were there and we were liable. Time-consuming and expensive.
Yeah.
So we've made a decision that, you know what, we'll take a slip-and-fall risk at the advantage of streamlining operations.
Gotcha.
That's
Thank
one
you.
Example.
Okay.
Thank you for asking. The university can do more to unleash entrepreneurialism and find best practices for achievements and scaling them where appropriate. We need to improve how we manage change and how we solve problems. And also we find that consultation is important, but there are pitfalls to over-consulting, especially as it affects the speed of innovation. Participants also said that we sometimes don't consult in the right ways. Importantly, we also learned that being highly decentralized gives units autonomy and nimbleness, but also can promote redundancy, institutional silos, and lack of alignment. We learned our human resource information system is out of date, hampering our ability to accurately benchmark or make data-driven decisions. We also launched the risk recalibration effort to change our culture. We identified more than 220 policies and processes for recalibration in 8 areas of opportunity: administrative optimization, finance, procurement, compliance, human resources, information technology, the service culture, and research infrastructure. We've made progress, but these areas of opportunity are actually somewhat limiting. Operational excellence doesn't just drop into an area. It cuts across areas of opportunity. It cuts across campuses, colleges, and across units, and it does not occur in silos. And let me give you a quick real example about a real person who helped make change. Craig Bounce is the Director of Technology Innovation with our College of Biological Sciences. Finding and developing innovative technology solutions in research and education, and helping with the day-to-day work of CBS is what he does. But the problem is that too much day-to-day work can overwhelm and bog down innovation. So Craig and the CBS IT department made a number of moves to put the core of IT back in the hands of the college. They transferred the position responsible for installing updates and software on the college computers, that is computer management, to central OIT. That move saved the college about $90,000 a year and freed the CBS staff to work on research support and educational endeavors such as instructional technology. It's not just a shifting of cost. Because of the nature of the work, the position is scalable. So as CBS moved some administrative IT work to our core office, we were also consolidating help desk operations. And so the same amount of work that an IT specialist needs to do to manage 500 computers can scale to having him or her manage 5,000 computers. It puts the CBS staff member who transferred to central OIT in a position that now can benefit others at the university. Big savings in time and money also came when the college moved its 3,000-plus web pages to a new web content management system. And when CBS lost their web manager to a new job, they took the opportunity to evaluate the responsibilities and not fill that position, saving $75,000. So together, that's an example of how a college saved about $165,000, or 5% of their administration budget, by breaking out of a silo, sharing across the university, and using modern technology. They are now spending less on information technology than they have any time in the past decade, but getting more than they have ever before. That's a great success story. We need hundreds of those success stories, and we are in the process of finding them. So we've begun to see patterns develop and baskets in which we can place the fruits of our opportunities. They are, more simply, standardization and centralization, cost-cutting and cost-containment, business efficiency, shared service, and, finally, revenue generation. Which leads us to the report we are presenting to you today. I'll give you the history. On January 8th, Chair Bonhoff and Majority Leader Bach wrote to me requesting, quote, a data-driven approach to analyzing the cost of delivering educational services at the University of Minnesota. You asked for a short-term analysis, such as a spans and layer studies, as well as an in-depth, longer-term examination. Asking for an interim report no later than March 15th, you requested these studies to, quote, develop clear and measurable analytics so that efficiency goals can be met. The University of Minnesota retained Simpson Consulting, a division of the Siegel Company, to conduct a spans and layers analysis of 4 central admin units: Office of Human Resources, Office of Budget and Finance, Information Technology, and Purchasing Services, who performs procurement for the university. Now, given the breadth of these units and the short time frame under which this work was to be accomplished, these 4 units were the only ones that we could adequately assess. But the university is committed to completing spans and layers analysis throughout the remainder of the administrative functions across the organization with an anticipated deadline of summer 2013. And the scope of Simpson's work for the report was shared and submitted with you and Leader Bach, as well as the legislative auditor, on Friday, January 25th. So first, let me walk you briefly through the concepts of spans and layers, which Simpson here refers to as levels. A span is the number of employees who report to one supervisor, sort of that wingspan. And so in this little cartoon of an organizational chart I have in front of you, you see that the CEO supervises seven individuals. So his span of control, her span of control, is seven. That's a healthy number. You see other situations in which a VP supervises 4.5 individuals, or in one case, one. And when you have a supervisor supervising one person, you have an opportunity for streamlining your organization. The management firm, consulting firm I mentioned earlier, Bain & Company, provides one way of understanding this data based on benchmarking numbers. And according to the Bain approach, the four units here are close to alignment in terms of the levels of each unit. In other words, I'm sorry, on the slide, these are the results for the four areas that we examined. And you'll see, for example, the Office of Information Technology in the upper right, that has six layers in that organization. Bain generally recommends no more than five or six levels in an organization, from the organization's leader to frontline employees. Bain generally recommends spans of control of approximately seven direct reports or higher, depending on the type of work being done. Average spans of control in the four units analyzed here range from a low of 3.63 direct reports in procurement to a high of 9.53 direct reports in OIT. For these units, for three of them, according to this way of thinking, the university could do more to increase the number of direct reports per supervisor. Bain does recommend a span of 6 to 7 in most cases, and because of the size of OIT, the average span of these four units taken together is 6.1, between 6 and 7. So taking advantage of this approach requires careful analysis now, position by position, to assure that potential changes make sense. So that's the Bain approach, and I'll tell you in a minute about the Simpson methodology, which is perhaps a little less intuitive. But before I do, let me walk you through the upper right, the Office of Information Technology, so that you can understand what this information is about. I don't expect to make you management consultants in this talk, but it will help you understand where we are. So if you look at level one, you see there's one person at level one. That is the vice president for information technology. He is a supervisor and supervises 14 people. So the average of 14 is 14. Those 14 people are all in level two, and they make up the 14 number in level two. Of those 14, 9 are supervisors and 5 are non-supervisors. The 9 supervisors supervise anywhere from 1, that's an opportunity, to 18, which is a big number, with an average span for that level of 8.11. Now, those 9 supervisors supervise 73 people in level 3, 50 of which are non-supervisors and 23 of which are supervisors. And those 23 people supervise anywhere from 1 to 38 individuals with an average of 12. And it percolates down. You'll see at the last level, level 5, we have 65 people, none of whom are supervisors, because that is at the bottom of the floor of the organizational chart.
President Kaler, again, sorry to interrupt you.
No, please.
When I went through the book and looked at the appendixes and the actual Simpson report, I saw all the data for the human resources, finance, and procurement, but the OIT, which is the one I was most interested in because it is so strong, I couldn't find it in there. So I don't know if it was just a missing sheet in the book or...
Madam Chair, we certainly apologize for that. We obviously have the data, and we will get it to you in paper copy. I apologize.
Thank you. Senator Fischbach.
Yes. Madam Chair, President Kaler, can you just go back to that level two?
Yes.
And explain to me why there's, and I was trying to listen closely, but 9 supervisors and 5 non-supervisors.
Non-supervisors. Right. So those 5 individuals at level 2 report to the level 1 supervisor, but they're not supervisors. So let me give you an example. We have a finance example, which is a really good one. We have a person who reports to the vice president for finance. Her name's Carol Fleck. She is responsible for over $1 billion of institutional debt. She manages that. She reports to the vice president, but she's not a supervisor.
Thank you.
Okay, so let me move to the Simpson report. Senator, question?
Yeah, Senator Pratt.
Thank you, members.
I think it's healthy to interrupt and ask your questions because I find otherwise when you get done, you've forgotten the question you had at the time. So Senator Pratt.
President Kaler, I was a bit shocked to see the 38. Does that include part-time staff or is it really truly 38 FTE?
Senator Pratt, Chair Bonoff, that's an example of a discovery that this shows that we need to dig into, and I can't tell you off the top of my head what those 38 are about, but I can tell you we're going to ask the question you just asked.
All right. Thank you.
Again, this is, Chair Bonoff, fresh information, so we need a little more time. And please do interrupt because I tend to get on a roll. So let me talk to you about the Simpson methodology. And that's illustrated on the slide in front of you. What you see here, again, in the Office of Information Technology, layers and spans, you'll see at the lower left-hand corner, 402. That is the number of individuals in level one with no supervisory responsibility. Above, then, you'll see at level two, 10 people who supervise one person, and that is a opportunity. But at no other level is there one person supervision. But if you go to finance, you'll see, for example, 8 people at level 2, 1 at level 3, 4, 5, that are supervising fewer people than the level they are at. So the Simpson rule of thumb is that the span of supervision should grow as you move in the organization. So in other words, organizations should be relatively flat and relatively broad. And this chart enables you to see that by an eye. That idea of the ratio of the spans to layers should be about 1 is an emerging industry standard, but it's also a starting point and not an end to itself.
President Kaler?
Yes, ma'am.
This is the part where I still haven't figured it out.
Okay,
so it's just confusing. I don't know if other members are having that challenge to understand the particular and how you do your one-to-one. I just don't understand the diagram yet. So could you, like, walk me through, pick one again and take me through, like, number by number?
Okay, I can do that.
Thank you.
So let me pick the procurement case here. So, again, at the bottom of the organization, 24 people with no supervisory, with a span of 0, no supervision.
Okay.
You go up the level above them. You have 4 individuals at that level. One of those individuals is only supervising one person.
Okay.
The minimum definition of a supervisor. But to the right of the red line, the area at which Simpson suggests is a healthy description. We have one person supervising 2, one supervising 3, and one supervising 4.
Got it.
Okay.
Thank you.
So again, this is it is complicated. It takes a little while to reconcile this way of looking at the organization with the Bain way that right. I did on the previous slide. But what is useful here is the red line idea, which is that as you go up in the organization, your supervisory span should change. Okay, and again, we can offline spend some time, Madam Chair.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Madam Chair, President Kaler, just as a follow-up, okay, the way I understand that you've explained this is that on that second level, there's 24 without supervisors.
Right.
And then you have those 4 supervisors on level 2. One has 1. One has 2 that they supervise, and then there's a 3 and a 4.
Right.
That doesn't add up to 24.
No. That's how many. Yes, that's because.
And President Kaler, if you'd like to have somebody from Simpson come to the
table.
Yeah,
and, you know, I should. This is complicated enough to do that. So I will call for some help.
I don't blame you.
Hello, Madam Chair.
Hello. Please introduce yourself for the
I'm Michael Malley with Simpson Consulting. So the Senator Fischbach, what was the it was the 24 that you were referring to in
Madam Chair, on that procurement level, the way that I would understand it is there's 24 people that need supervising somewhere along the line. And then, but then right above them, there are not enough supervisors.
Right. And Madam Chair, Senator Fischbach, remember the, and correct me if I'm wrong, some of those 24 are supervised by other people at higher levels. Remember the VP who had two people under him who had no supervisory level?
Okay.
So it will be true that if you add up all of the spans, you will get all of the people supervised.
Madam Chair, President Kaler, thank you. It makes more sense, but it still doesn't make sense in the sense that, have people. The way you've set up the chart, it doesn't flow well, like who's reporting to who, I guess. And that's where the confusion is.
And that's right,
Kaler.
Senator Fischbach, Chair Bonoff, and sorry to not be as polite as I should be. Excuse me. You're right. And so this is one way to look at the organization. The Bain organizational chart way is perhaps a more intuitive way to look at the organization, but this gives you a visual idea of where there are issues and where there aren't. And our friends from Simpson are better at reading that than we are.
Madam Chair,
Mr. O'Malley,
we are working on a more intuitive way of presenting this versus a more straightforward, intuitive way of seeing the results.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Yes.
And finally, the pie charts at the top here indicate the percentage of the organization that have supervisory responsibility below an optimum number. In other words, 1, 2. And you'll see that the percentages there vary from about 5% to 9%, representing opportunity to be examined.
And President Kaler, with regard to that, what is the benchmark standard that they're using in terms of if you're more than blank, you have an opportunity?
Well, I think, Madam Chair, that if you're more than zero, you have an opportunity. And so we'll look at all of those, recognizing, again, that depending on what these folks do, not having a supervisory, not being a supervisor or supervising just a small number in a highly specialized area might be okay.
Right.
And having 38 might be okay or might not.
It's function dependent, I'm sure.
Indeed.
Yeah, but President Kaler, I guess I was just asking, so are they using more the standard Bain, like you'd like to have a 6 to 7 span, or are they using a different, or are they using the 1 to 1 where they get the percentages?
I think, Madam Chair, we will sort that out as we go forward. You heard our friend from Simpson talk about where.
Okay.
And again, I apologize for
that's
for
no
not having this all
necessary.
Done. But it's
you've
very,
done it fast.
It's
Thank
very
you.
Fresh information. Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Okay. So to review, we don't have an excessive number of layers. We could do more to increase the number of direct reports per supervisor across the units. The level ratio of spans to levels appropriate, but again, can improve them in select areas. And so we have work to do. I characterize this these four units, which is all that we've looked at this stage, as a good organization with room to improve. So in addition to the spans and layers analysis, your request, we will complete the benchmarking and diagnostic study. The university has retained Huron Consulting Group, a global consulting firm that has worked with 94 of the top 100 research universities to benchmark university administrative costs across the four areas of finance, human resource, IT, and procurement. And the benchmarking will provide an independent third-party benchmarking of operations in the four functional areas. They will identify opportunities for improvement, barriers to optimal performance, and most importantly, leading practices at peer institutions the university should consider. That project will be completed by 31 May 13. We eagerly await the findings, and we will share them with you. So, the university will use the data from these reports to reduce cost and improve operations, better align human and other resources to advance our mission. I am committed to improving operational excellence in all that the university does. And we expect that changing some of these alignments will require tough decisions. We will make those changes in an open and transparent and fair way. I have repeatedly said we will reduce administrative costs and move those dollars to core mission activities. It is, however, premature to declare a specific cost reduction target that will result from this work. We first have to complete the data, benchmark the organization, and see where we sit. When we have the data, we'll make changes to move. I often say you can't move if you can't measure, and this data gives us that baseline for the series of specific next steps. So the next steps include completing administrative spans and layers analysis and completing the benchmarking study. In all areas where spans or layers are inappropriate, we'll fully analyze the function and work and set near-term goals for reducing layers and increasing spans of control. And to prevent spans from creeping back into the organization over time, we'll ensure all non-academic positions are properly classified and fit within an optimal structure. Very importantly, to help with that, we're expediting our job family studies and job classification redesign. So let me explain that. The university's job classification system was developed decades ago. It categorizes position by a job code and then groups related jobs into job families and IT or communications, for example. Over time, as the number of job codes grew, we created an unwieldy and inefficient system. New jobs rapidly evolving in the marketplace, and many employees were being assigned to job codes that did not truly reflect the work being done. To date, the university has conducted 4 job family studies, and with the support of an outside consultant, the university will conduct the remaining 14 job family studies over the course of the next 24 months and map the job codes to the redesigned classification system. So when completed, the university will have fewer classifications and the classifications will accurately reflect the work being performed. Managers and employees will have more transparent career paths and the new classifications will be easier to administer. They'll also so ensure that the jobs and the corresponding salaries are comparable with the marketplace. Job classification system more accurately reflects what employees do and forms and facilitates better management. This kind of analytical information gives a baseline foundation for planning the strategic development of our workforce to match our institutional priorities. It will complement and strengthen the spans and layers analysis and enable us to make decisions more effectively and efficiently. Madam Chair and members of the committee, this is not easy work, and typically universities embarking on this level of transformation, which is substantial, take 3 to 5 years to fully implement changes. I am not interested in taking 3 to 5 years to implement these changes. We will expedite this over the next 2 to 3 years with our foot on the gas. So that is where we stand in relation to the progress report you sought by March 13th, and we are 3 days early for the record. Where we stand on operational excellence in general, I believe, is impressive and encouraging. There is no finite checklist. And what we call OPEX is a new way to do things, keeping in mind the importance of stewarding our university. But please let me briefly review our progress to date. As I said when I began, we've been talking to the Board of Regents, my leadership team, and to the entire university staff about operational excellence since the day I was hired. We completed the first of their kind studies to examine the full cost of mission activities and define administrative costs at the university. Last summer, we completed a study on the cost of instruction, research, public service, and student aid. And last fall, we completed a groundbreaking administrative cost study detailing where we spend our funds for direct mission, mission support, and administrative leadership. We found that 9% of our fully allocated costs are for administration and management. That's a baseline against which to measure progress. That information is in the report you have in front of you. Let me take an aside. That analysis is critically important. higher education as an industry suffers from a lack of generally recognized ways to report activity. And so universities, being different from one another, are frequently compared in the way an apple is compared to an orange. And as a result, misinformation, information out of context, appears, and institutions are criticized or lauded without proper context. We need to be able to benchmark our institution and see how year to year we drive our operations. My hope is that other institutions will see the value in our approach and join with us. But for now, we will benchmark from our baseline and move forward.
Excuse me, President Keller. So when you say it that way, are you suggesting that your benchmarking is going to be against your standard versus other institutions or in addition?
Madam Chair, it will be in addition to the degree we can find comparable data. The challenge is that an institution like the University of Minnesota, which has a land grant mission, a medical school, a public outreach and engagement mission, a large research element, five campuses under a single president, there isn't a university that's exactly like it anywhere in the country. Hmm. And so as you slice and dice, it's very difficult to compare. The IPEDS data, which I shared with the committee the first time we were together, is a classic example of this. It is highly variable, almost arbitrary, and not useful in comparing various institutions. And I want us to be the leaders in the conversation about how to do this better.
So, President Keller, we're going to be hearing at our committee from Professor Roland Miranda from University of Michigan on Thursday, because that was one of the first conversations I had in terms of an institution that's really tackled this issue. So would you say that the benchmarking work that they've done, and, you know, we've discussed the Berkeley report, we've read that you don't think those really are useful?
Madam Chair. Yes, they are useful, but one must understand the degree to which they're comparable and which they're not. Michigan is an easy example. Michigan State has the land grant mission for the state of Michigan, not us.
Yeah.
We have distributed campuses, but we don't have a system. Illinois, for example, has three campuses, each with a chancellor, and they report to a president. I am the president of the five-campus system and also the administrative leader of the Twin Cities campus. So these costs of system administration, which are held over here separately in Illinois, are folded into the Twin Cities budget. So if you compare University of Minnesota Twin Cities with University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana, we're going to look more expensive because they've deallocated their system costs somewhere else. So it's really
It's complicated.
And that sounds like a cop-out to say it's complicated, but it actually is complicated.
President Kaler, nobody's even thinking that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Klassen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. President Kaler, in addressing just what you were talking about, have you sorted out the expenses related at the University of Minnesota campus, Twin Cities, in running those other campuses? In other words, are some of the costs and some of the personnel that we're seeing here, are they actually attributed to running some of those satellite locations? I hate to call them satellite locations, but the other institutions around the state under the University of Minnesota umbrella.
Senator Klassen, Madam Chair, to some degree that we do, but particularly since we've eliminated the Office of System Administration that was led by Senior Vice President Jones and really integrated the system activities into our central offices, we've actually, ironically, made it more difficult to tease those apart. But we've saved money by eliminating an office whose job it was to see all of those things. So, for example, the chancellors report directly to me. So what fraction of my expense should be attributed to those institutions, I couldn't tell you. Mm-hmm. So it's actually very difficult to do that. And we've made the decision to not do that in a mindful way. What we have done is broken out the costs of education, because we obviously know what the budgets of those institutions are. And so in those footprints, we can see what costs are allocated across the various missions. But I can't answer directly the question you've asked.
Thank you.
Okay.
So So, Madam Chair, I believe this is my last slide. So, because I do want to tell you some success stories. It's really, we frankly have done a lot to do this in the past 20 months. We're implementing an enterprise systems upgrade for human resource, student, and financial systems, essential for us to have the technology backbone for the institution so that we can do what we need to do. We eliminated, as I mentioned, the Office for Academic Administration. Cost savings there, we estimate at $1.1 million of recurring and $500,000 of non-recurring funds. Last month, the University of Minnesota Foundation and the Minnesota Medical Foundation merged, improving donor relations and reducing back office costs by up to $1 million annually. September 2012, to better align our operations and reduce duplication, we implemented a dotted line reporting relationship, which simply means that central administrative offices in HR, IT, budget, and communications directly connect with the distributed elements in the colleges and other units around those areas. Promotes best practices, promotes clarity, reduces duplication. In May 2010, a system-wide inventory project found nearly 4,000 servers, computer servers, from 50 different hardware manufacturers located in more than 225 locations across the University of Minnesota. Since then, we've reduced the number of physical servers by half, and approximately 40 server rooms have been closed. Cost savings realized of approximately $1.5 million ongoing. $1.5 million of one-time cost was avoided by closing server rooms and leveraging a virtualization service. IT professionals across the U are working together to consolidate over 70 independently run help desks into a single point of contact for technology needs. Several years ago, we became the first major public research university to tap Google for its ever-evolving suite of applications. And we were one of the first to offer the entire suite of applications to faculty and staff. Analysis by the external research firm Gartner Incorporated estimates that move is valued at more than $15 million a year. We've improved accounts receivable billings and collections, reducing outstanding balances on 39,000 invoices with cash activity of over $700 million. We closed the Bursar's office, savings of more than $775 million annually. With strategic sourcing and e-procurement, we're saving $7.6 million system-wide in purchasing. We are home to more than 850 buildings and over 29 million square feet around the state, and each day well over 100,000 faculty, staff, students, and visitors use our facilities. We've begun a space utilization initiative. More than 320,000 gross square feet have been decommissioned, reducing annual operating costs by $1.5 million. We've saved $4.6 million annually with a system-wide conservation and sustainability effort. In 2011, the university implemented a new custodial program on the Twin Cities campus featuring team cleaning, saving the university $3.1 million annually. Transition to automatic parking. Eliminating parking attendants, we save $1.3 million annually and generate an additional $180,000 in increased revenue. It's difficult to eliminate those jobs, but we're clearly being asked by the people of Minnesota to do more with less. So beyond the spans and layers and benchmarking activity, next steps, developing metrics and a dashboard, aligning our work to strategic priorities identified by strategic planning activity that will begin in the fall, drive alignment across a very decentralized organization by standardizing processes, and keeping our eye on the ball every day to work smarter and reduce costs. I believe, as the record of the past 20 months shows, I am committed to this, as is my senior leadership team. There is no finish line. With new technologies, new teaching methods, and uncertain economic times, we will never rest in striving to make the University of Minnesota as efficient and effective as it can be to carry out our missions. So as we prepare Minnesota's best qualified students for the jobs of tomorrow, we will ensure Minnesota's prosperity. With that, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I conclude my report and stand for your questions. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much, President Kaler. Members? Questions? Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, President, for the presentation. A couple months ago when you were in here, we were asking a lot of you, and I asked what we could do for you. What suggestions do you have for the legislature? And I apologize if your staff has gotten back to me and I haven't seen that, but I haven't seen it. So Have you guys gotten answers to those to that question,
Senator, Madam Chair? I don't know if we've gotten that pulled together yet. We certainly are working on it. I've asked my senior leaders to consider what you've offered. And it certainly will be the case that we will identify regulatory or other rules and regulations within the state that we could benefit by relaxation. And we will be back to you well before the end of session with that. And I do apologize. We've been a little busy since I was here last, so we will work on your request assiduously.
Madam Chair, it'd be nice to be able to get those recommendations back. You know, maybe we can act on some of them before we pass the omnibus higher ed bill. So I'm sure you know that already, but thank you.
Thank you,
Good.
Senator.
Thanks, Senator Peterson. Committee? When you look at this, you've identified the opportunities with regard to the spans. What do you think ultimately is the greatest, as you've talked to Huron Consulting, what do you see as the greatest opportunities for transformation? I mean, are you looking, do you predict that you will embark on a more system-wide shared services approach? What are your hypotheses? What are your thoughts?
Madam Chair, I think the elements that we will come to are the elements that many of our peer institutions have come to. Standardization, maximization of processes, not always centralization. There are many things that, in fact, are done better in a distributed way. But we need to look carefully at what those are and to be sure that we execute processes across the institution in the best possible way. Our enterprise software upgrade is actually critical to that because almost all the business processes we use are electronic, and we need to be sure those best practices are in place. So that's one. The other thing that I can't overstate is we need an efficient and effective organization in which our employees are fully engaged, they're proud to come to work, they're inventing new ways to do their job, and they have high morale. And so our ability to have better supervisor training, better career paths, clearer job families, better alignment of salary and responsibility, those are hallmarks of great institutions. And I want this to be an organizationally great institution because that backbone is what our research, teaching, and outreach mission deserve to have. So you're really seeing what I'd like to think is a smart way to centralize where is appropriate, to professionalize, and to minimize. As we go through this, we'll also take hard looks at all that we do. We've done a review of our centers and institutes recently, and we're closing 9% of those. And we're going to take a harder look at the largest 25 in terms of dollar amount to be sure that they're operating as well as they can be. So it's a constant process improvement, continuous improvement activity.
President Kaler, I had asked originally to make sure that the salary analysis was done at the same time, and it was put in this report, and I'm paging to look for it right now, but we haven't discussed it at all. So I think it would be helpful for the committee. I guess in the book it's on page 11. It looks at, so the average salary of supervisors in human resources is $94,000, of non-supervisors is $58,000, and you can see that on page 11 again. You look at IT, the same. How do those numbers, there's no correlation in terms of comparables with regard to where those numbers fit with other institutions or with your targets. What did you think about those numbers?
So, Madam Chair, we do look at our salaries in areas that we compare both within higher education indices and in the local market. And we generally find, and I'll ask my vice president for human resources to correct me, but we're generally slightly below the higher education market and 3% or so below the private sector market for comparable jobs. And again, we do that on an annual basis. And I believe that's actually in that what I just told you is in the text of the report. And my Vice Very President good. Brown believes it is.
Very good. Thank you. Well, I appreciate that you did put that information in, as it was something that I had, because I think you can't look at anything in a vacuum. You have to look at the functions with the cost.
And Madam Chair, I completely agree. And in these kind of administrative areas and in higher education in general, we are in a marketplace. And so we have to be able there are great benefits at working at the university, but our salaries need to be competitive in order to attract the people that we want to be here.
And what percentage do you know of the administrative costs are in the departments versus in your central administration?
Madam Chair, the fraction of costs that are central versus distributed into the colleges and departments varies by function. So I can't give you a hard number there. We can get you that analysis if you would like, unless Vice President Brown or Vice President Fitzenreiter knows that off the top of their heads. Vice President Brown.
Thank you.
Chair Bonnef, members of the committee, I'm Catherine Brown. I'm Vice President for Human Resources at the university. This is really information that will come out of the benchmarking work that we're going to be doing that will help us understand whether we are spending the right amounts in comparison to others and the work that, and examining the work we're doing, and are we really getting the most value out of that. So that will be coming up in the benchmarking review primarily.
You know, as we look at culturally what's happened post-recession, I think all these conversations are happening nationally because the cost pressures are just tremendous. And, you know, the cost pressures on you as we've disinvested, yet in addition, you've, you know, really grown the University of Minnesota in the last decade in terms of what you're doing from a research perspective, in terms of, you know, your student perspective. So I guess we always just have to ask the value question. And one of the things that I was wondering about with regard to your contract with Huron Consulting, and by the way, as far as I'm concerned, you accepted our request. You delivered this report. You've identified a plan for going forward. And so, you know, people have said to me, well, did you do what you asked? Absolutely, you did. So I appreciate that. So these questions aren't about that. These questions are then to drill down and really understand what we're dealing with and what, you know, what our university is dealing with. So with regard to the Huron Consulting contract, I wondered, was there thought to having part of it be performance-based, you know, in terms of it's just a flat fee? It doesn't show, there's no incentive, as far as I can tell, to if they identify big cost savings in the future, or, you know, was there thought to that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would say that we did not think about that at this level. I think as we begin to identify real layers of opportunity, then a more sophisticated approach to contracting with an outside firm could be made. But the benchmarking that we're going to do really here is at a level that lets us use their database, and frankly, offense meant the access to the database is a key element. We don't have that. We have to buy that. And so that's the element of the contract. But we did not, to answer your question, consider that.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Senator Klassen.
Yeah, thank you. President Kaler, we've heard about administrative cost procedures and processes and things, and I really appreciate you sharing that. Going beyond that, are you conducting any studies and looking at programs, project analysis? Over the years, University of Minnesota dropped the General College a number of years ago. There's been some cutbacks in some of the master's programs. Are you doing a study in those areas, more of the programs?
Senator Claussen, Madam Chair, we will embark on a strategic planning activity in the fall that is aimed at doing for the academic side of the House the planning and structure that we're doing on the administrative side of the House right now. And we ultimately arrive at very difficult decisions. And my ability, my provost and dean's abilities to make hard decisions about academic programs has to have as a foundation confidence that the administrative and management side of the university is using its dollars as effectively as we can. So I've been in this business for a while, and I have seen efforts to address academic elements that haven't had that foundational belief, and they fail. And so my goal is to be able to have this institution at the level administratively that we can move with confidence forward to align academic elements that are important. And it's a great big university. Do we do a lot? And so we do a lot of things. Is every single one of them as good as it can be academically? No, it's not. And we will work on that.
Thank you.
But we have we have a ton that are absolutely excellent.
President Kaler, I'm sure that your workforce is probably concerned about the thought of redesign and reengineering because people always think it's their job that's going to go. But in fact, oftentimes it's attrition or it's redeployment, and so it isn't really as frightening as people think. But with regard to that, your supervisor reduction, the Office of IT, were those folks, because you said you went from 70 to 20, were they redeployed? Did they go someplace else? How did that go?
Madam Chair, that is a work in process, and so I would ask you to let me just leave it at that.
Thank you. Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And President Kaler, thank you for the presentation. My question is, what has the response been internally since the national media circus has kind of focused on the University of Minnesota and then the legislature requesting this report, and now that the report's back, can you just share with us what you feel you can publicly on what's been done internally and what the response has been internally?
Sir, Senator Miller, Madam Chair, I would say it's really – there's several answers to that question, and so I'll just kind of walk through different aspects for you. And if I don't respond to your satisfaction, I'm sure you'll ask me some more. But first off, the sort of national attention story. Most people, when you look at the numbers and you understand what I presented to this committee the first time I was with you and what we've published subsequently – you know, the university has critics that will never be convinced by facts. If you believe something about an institution for long enough, you'll believe it no matter what the facts say. And so there's a group. But people who understand facts realize the really out-of-context story, particularly with respect to iPad data. And so I think that is what it is. Internally, certainly, I've been on this operational excellence activity since I got there. So it's no surprise internally that I am focused on this and that my senior team is focused. So there's been a buzz, a level of concern, as the chair would indicate, but also some levels of excitement about opportunity to do their job better. And I get feedback from employees about, good, I want to make this change, and now I feel empowered to do something different than I did before. So there are good aspects to that, as well as the ones driven by some insecurity. With respect to that, if I could, it is true that given the demographics of our workforce, that retirement and attrition will go a long way towards alignment that we need to make. And when it doesn't, we will be as transparent and fair appropriate as we can be about separations. So I would say a general buzz around that, but again, recognizing it not only as a threat, but also as an opportunity.
Does anyone request the woman from Huron? I'm so pleased you're here. I hate to waste that opportunity. Maybe if you just come forward to say a couple words about what you see the future to be as you embark on this challenge?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Laura Yeager, the practice leader for Huron's higher education practice. We feel privileged to have the opportunity to work with the university on this important initiative. We have worked with institutions, and particularly in the last couple years, who are in a very similar situation as the University of Minnesota, and unfortunately have also had the same kind of publicity and attention around this, and have, as such, you know, have put in a number of programs similar to the University of Minnesota to try to begin to drive real transformative change across the organization. And so we've been working with a number of the University of Minnesota's peers, privates, publics, of all shapes and sizes, to kind of work through a process to help them better understand their environment, where the opportunities are. I think the University of Minnesota has done some really nice foundational work with the president and his team. And, you know, we're just getting up to speed this week in terms of a lot of that groundwork that has been done and beginning to partner to, you know, identify what are those areas that will likely drive the greatest opportunities for efficiencies, effectiveness. A lot of the opportunities that we find are, you know, not just across central administration, but a lot of those costs and activities happens in schools and departments. And so our focus will be to make sure that we get that information as well, not only on the Twin Cities campus, but across the system, as President Kaler mentioned, can really leverage some good activities in terms of whether that's centralization, standardization, and the better use of technology to drive some of those opportunities.
Very good. Well, thank you. And we would like to be apprised of how that's going, and that'll be up to you to how best to be in communication with us. But we're very interested, and so we'd like to be your partner in that process. And particularly to what Senator Peterson mentioned, if there's things that we can do from a legislative perspective to remove obstacles, please let us know.
Senator, we certainly will. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you very much. Sure. Okay. I think that completes this.
Thank you.
Thank you. Scott just stepped out. So I know Senator Dibble's been waiting patiently, and now we're ready for him. Oh, there he is. Good. Okay. Oh, my God. Oh.
So, Madam Chair,
Senator Dibble.
Thank you. Just got a little technology issue. We got some time.
Senator Dibble, given the interest of time, let's just do the bill.
All right. Very good.
Okay.
Thank you. We'll try to figure it out while we're speaking because I think the testimony comes first, and then we'll show the two-minute video if we can figure out how to make it work in the meantime. Madam Chair, members, I have before you Senate File 1164, and there's an A1 amendment, Madam Chair, if we could pass that out. It's a kind of a technical amendment. Is that in your packets?
Members have the A1 amendment. So, Senator Claussen, you want to move that, and then Senator Dibble can address that.
Yes, Madam Chair, I move Amendment A1 to Senate File 1164.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Senator Dibble on the.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just describe the bill very briefly, and then we have a couple of folks who can speak to it. What Senate File 1164, it's a Senate file or file that we've gotten a couple of emails on, I hear. So there's some interest in this issue. And it's very simple, and what it would simply propose to do is to facilitate the adoption of animals that are in laboratories in Minnesota that are supported, that are university laboratories or laboratories that are working with university institutions, allow those animals to be adopted into families' homes rather than being destroyed when they're done with the experiments that they're in the lab for, unless, of course, those animals are needed for further research and there needs to be a necropsy and they need to put those animals down and examine their tissues for further research. And so it was simply asked that those labs, rather than destroying those animals for really no reason, work with animal rescue organizations and allow those animals to be adopted. It's very simple, very straightforward. It provides for, there's some language that provides for the ability of these labs to enter into an agreement with the adoption rescue organizations if they feel like they want to maintain a private understanding, a contractual agreement, or some understanding of some sort to protect for confidentiality, privacy, liability, et cetera. That's the language around may enter into an agreement with the animal rescue organization to protect the facility, and that's what that language is designed to achieve. With that, Madam Chair, we have Shannon Keith, who's here to speak to the bill, and then we have Mr. Zellhofer.
Thank you.
Ms. Keith.
Thank you. Good afternoon, esteemed members of the committee. And thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of SF 1164 to facilitate the retirement and adoption of some dogs and cats from state-funded research laboratories. My name is Shannon Keith, and I'm the president of a nonprofit organization called Animal Rescue Media and Education. I'm also a practicing attorney specializing in animal protection law. My organization is 9 years old, headquartered in Los Angeles. We also have an additional office in the Loring Park neighborhood of Minneapolis. The primary program my rescue organization runs is called Beagle Freedom Project. It started 2 years ago when I was contacted by a laboratory technician in California asking if we had the capacity to take in a couple of beagles that were no longer needed in a research study. These dogs had spent years in laboratory confinement and were going to be euthanized if adopted homes could not be located. My organization agreed to take them. I filmed both their transfer into our care and the first 20 minutes of their newfound freedom. The dogs had never before experienced outdoors, grass, sunshine, or a loving touch. For the first 10 minutes after I opened their doors, they were too nervous to even step out. When they eventually did, they walked awkwardly and gingerly on the grass as they had never felt anything but concrete and steel. The video captures a remarkable transformation as their canine instincts kicked in, and they went from numbered research subjects to cautiously playful dogs. The video went viral on YouTube and has been seen by close to 1 million viewers. Within the immediate following weeks and months of this publicity, several other companies and universities contacted us and wanted to participate in our retirement and rehoming program. Within the last 24 months, we have worked with 11 different laboratories from several parts of the country and internationally, and we have rescued over 110 research beagles. Our biggest rescue campaign to date was on Thanksgiving of 2011, when we flew 40 beagles from Spain to the United States to be rehomed. A pharmaceutical company there had closed and was liquidating all of their animals. Thanks to a persistent veterinarian on staff in the company, we were able to negotiate for the release of the last group of the beagles. This story was covered by the national news media in the U.S. NBC Nightly News even reported on the rescue for two consecutive nights because they had such an overwhelming response from their viewers about the dogs and how they could help them. For the 40 beagles we saved that night, we received over 6,000 adoption applications. This reaction continues to be the case for every rescue we do. The opportunity to help these dogs has touched a very sensitive nerve in the public, as people want to give something back to those animals who have given so much for the sake of testing our cosmetics, household products, drugs, and medical procedures. This is not controversial. Indeed, some of the strongest support for Beagle Freedom Project has come actually from laboratory technicians themselves, who are often pained to see the animals they took care of, sometimes for years, killed because there exists no protocol to allow these dogs and cats to be freed. Many of these laboratory employees stay in touch with my organization and find it rewarding and therapeutic to track the progress and happiness of the beagles. This is one of the most remarkable aspects of the Beagle Freedom Project because it often bridges opposing viewpoints with regards to animal testing around a shared common ground, the concern for the well-being of the animals. This bill will not stop any research from going forward. It will simply establish a new factor of consideration about the fate of a dog or cat at the end of the study. A law like SF 1164 is needed as well. While many laws currently exist that address, often with exactitude, the details of laboratory life, from bedding, feed, water access, enrichment, pain management, etc., there are no standards identified for what happens after the research is concluded. It is currently up to the discretion of each institution as to whether or not a student, a technician, or other associate can individually adopt an animal. A primary factor preventing the expansion of this opportunity is the lack of coordination with non-affiliated animal rescue groups that otherwise could be instrumental in processing these adoptions. This bill would encourage this sort of collaboration when possible. Some might think if a program like Beagle Freedom Project can be so successful on a voluntary basis, why should the state mandate the participation of its publicly funded institutions? And the answer is simple and slightly sad. Beagle Freedom Project is far from successful with the voluntary surrender of research dogs. Currently, there are roughly 70,000 dogs in about 350 laboratories across the country, a dozen of those here in Minnesota. In 2 years' time, Beagle Freedom Project has worked with just 11 labs and freed 110 dogs. These lives we have been able to save are but a small drop in the bucket. Too many otherwise healthy and adoptable dogs and cats are being destroyed because of a lack of legal guidance. A standard needs to exist to offer an incentive to these institutions. We should also not fear that these dogs and cats will exacerbate the problem of an already overwhelmed animal rescue and shelter system. Pet overpopulation is indeed a tragedy in desperate need of remedying, but the number of possible dogs and cats to be released would likely be an infinitesimal fraction of what these rescue organizations already experience. I would be surprised if the representatives from the university disagreed with this point. Additionally, I can add from personal experience in this field that my organization has never had any problems finding appropriate homes. In fact, just the opposite exists. We have too many applications for the number of dogs we're able to retire and rehome. The number of dogs and cats to be released will likely be small because research institutions like the University of Minnesota are required to euthanize many of the animals after the studies end for the sake of tissue samples and necropsy reports. This bill will not prevent this. It only asks that those few that are not destroyed be given a chance at life. With regard to the health of the animals and at what point they are not suitable for adoption, I would suggest that the contracted animal rescue organization make that determination. These organizations make this decision on a daily basis already, factoring in an animal's health, age, temperament, and chance at adoption when deciding whether to spend their resources sustaining their lives. It's not an enviable position, but one these organizations do professionally. My organization will, of course, take any of the research beagles, no matter how old, untrained, or sick they be. Our position is that after all they have endured for us, they deserve some fresh air, a soft spot on the couch, some affection. Whether that be for 10 years, or just for a few moments, or a few weeks, it's better for them to die in comfort, at least briefly cared for, than alone and unknown. Miski,
can you wrap up your comments?
Yes, okay. I'll skip. The research animals are very resilient and make great family companions. I've personally witnessed the 110 dogs that we have rescued go from shell-shocked little survivors to funny, curious, affectionate, loyal, cherished family members. I did want to show a video, but unfortunately there's problems with the projection system or the disc. But I just want to tell you briefly what's on it, and you all have a copy of it, which should play. What I did was I showed examples of the dogs that we have rescued, their first steps on the grass, that we do in-house veterinary care, including massage therapy and touch therapy. And I showed photos of these dogs with their family members now and how they're thriving in their home environments. So to conclude, as I said, I've personally experienced this. I don't think that this is anything that is controversial at all. It's something that is necessary, that we need, and I think is great in the public interest. So I thank you for listening.
Yep, Ms. Keith, and we thank you. It's just we have a bunch of dog lovers on this committee, so people are very receptive to it. We squeeze this bill in because of deadline, and so that's why we've got a lot of bills to get through. So
thank you.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair Bonhoff and committee members. My name is Aaron Zoffer, and I first want to start off by thanking you for looking into this issue and explore possibilities to this opportunity. This is an important subject that will determine the fate of a dog's and cat's life after they're used in research. My testimony has to deal with the subject on a personal level and how my dog, Junior, has moved me to be a champion of this bill. This all started for me when I was watching NBC Nightly News on Thanksgiving 2011 when a story caught my attention. 40 dogs that were used in research were now being given a second chance at life. I watched as these dogs, who were flown halfway around the world, caught their first breath of fresh air in Los Angeles. Watching the event unfold is hard to explain, as the experience sometimes leaves me speechless. It is a little overwhelming to watch these dogs take their first steps after a research study, knowing that they're really lucky to be doing so. The desperation, stress, and longing you see in their faces of these little creatures breaks your heart. I felt it was my obligation to provide a safe and loving home to one of these dogs, knowing these dogs had sacrificed so much for research. I was one of over 6,000 applicants. Luckily, I happened to be friends with the organizer of this event and Beagle Freedom Project President Shannon Keith. On December 26th of 2011, Junior flew to Minneapolis Airport and started his new life here in Minnesota with me. I picked him up, gave him a big hug, and felt so lucky for both of us. He was startled at first. He carried a lot of traumatic baggage. He would not leave the couch or the living room for the first week. I had to feed him by hand and carried him outside for walks. Hallways, doorways, and especially the elevator were very scary places. With lots of love and patience, Junior came out of his shell, and his little personality appeared. Junior's new life means trips to Mississippi Dog Park, where he could sniff new smells, run, and walk by the river, as demonstrated here by this picture. Life is always better with a bone, a belly pet, and with all beagles, any extra morsel of food. Junior loves to cuddle, especially on very cold nights. He is not a perfect dog, but a normal dog indeed, and sometimes he likes to get in trouble. Sometimes I get to say good Junior, sometimes I get to say bad Junior, but at the end of the day, the most important thing I can say is my Junior, knowing that he is alive and well with my family and was not put down at the end of his research study. This bill that is in front of you today will prevent dogs and cats from being killed unnecessarily. Even if it is only one dog, it is worth it, as I can testify to that. Both Junior and his archenemy, the cat, are animals that are emotional, sentient, and intelligent creatures that have families and complex social systems. These animals that share the ability to feel joy just as much as they have the ability to feel pain. Every time I see the tattoos in Junior's ear, I am once again reminded how lucky he is and how lucky I am. These animals deserve a chance, our protection, our voices, and the passage of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Dibble. On line 1.14, what does that mean to protect the facility?
Madam Chair, that language, it starts back on, it has to do with the enter into an agreement, and that's the language that we provide so that if facilities want to work with these rescue organizations, but want to enter into an agreement that protects confidentiality, privacy, or, you know, they want to give the dogs but don't want to be liable if the dogs have behavior problems or some other sort of problem, they can enter into those agreements to allow for some of those considerations.
Okay. Council's just walked back into the room, but I asked about the protect the facility question. So if it turns out that we need extra language to make sure that that meets the legal standard, we'll let you know.
Thank you. And okay. I've had some communication with University of Minnesota as well as the Life Science Alley folks. I don't know if they're going to come forward or not. They indicated they probably weren't going to because I think they're comfortable with, you know, with the goals of the bill with these sorts of provisions.
Okay.
And I've assured them if we need to develop a little language to button that up, we sure can do that.
Well, very good. Members, any questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Dibble and testifiers, thank you for your presentation. Great pictures.
Video would have brought it home.
My question first is, so the research, the university or the research facility has to first offer these dogs. In what form? Is that written form or like, how are they offered and who are they offered to? And how long is that process? And is it after 30 days or 60 days or?
Madam Chair, we specifically, Senator Miller, you know, specifically don't, you know, we didn't want to create a whole process and an enforcement mechanism and a bunch of government, frankly. You know, so we left that deliberately open so that, you know, research facilities could figure out, you know, we have these rescue organizations and maybe Mr. Zellhofer, Ms. Keith can describe, you know, there are quite a few of them around. They're pretty easy to find. I'd say it's probably as easy as picking up the phone and saying, got a bunch of dogs. We're retiring them. We'd rather not destroy them. Can you come get them? Here's a little contract we can sign, and we're good to go.
Okay. And Madam Chair.
Senator Miller.
One more question. Senator Dibble, the first two lines, a higher education research facility that receives public money, including tax-exempt status. What does that mean?
Senator Dibble.
Madam President, I think that was just to clarify that, and I'll have counsel help me. I didn't actually draft this language, kind of described it to them. But we're basically trying to make sure that we captured our state colleges and universities. Or the labs that are working with state colleges and universities on publicly funded research.
So Madam Chair,
Senator Miller,
Senator Dibble, or Council, Senator Dibble, would you be open to, if this is what you're getting at, could we say a tax-exempt higher education research facility
sure.
that receives public money? Would you be open to that oral amendment if that works for Council and everybody on the committee? It's just a little less confusing, at least for me.
So, I'm sorry, say that again.
We want to know if this is the wording only tattoos out, or does it include the...
So, is Council with...
Council had to step out.
Oh.
Here he comes. Here he comes.
We're lost. Now we're very confused.
And members, we are going to lay this over for possible inclusion so we can finish it. But Mr. Fuller... Senator Miller requested that we move the tax-exempt part insert before higher education, so it would say a tax-exempt higher education research facility.
We can just strike. Or, Madam Chair.
Senator Dibble.
We could probably just strike that tax-exempt language entirely.
Wonderful.
I think...
Better. Thank you.
Just confuses the issue.
Madam Chair, I move that we strike... on line 1.8 and 1.9, including tax-exempt status.
Good. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Adopted. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dibble, just kind of as I'm thinking through this bill, I think about liability, and when we bring these dogs, we've heard the stories that these dogs have a hard time reacclimating or acclimating into a normal setting. My question would be around liability. Do these agreements to protect the facility, do those include liability, or are we only talking about privacy?
Madam Chair, Senator Pratt, absolutely. I believe I articulated liability. I'm sorry if I didn't articulate it clearly enough, but privacy and liability, absolutely.
I probably missed it. Thank you.
Right, thanks.
Chair, I'd like to move the bill.
Senator Torres-Ray moves the Senate file 1164. He recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you very much. Tell all those people who wrote us that we got their appreciation. They don't need to write back.
Madam Chair, that was very well said. Thank you.
All right.
Senator Fischbach, if it's important to you, you can go before me. Would you like to do that?
Well, I have had
emails
about that. Is he still in?
Is he still in?
Okay. Thank you.
So we're going to switch the schedule up quickly. We're just going to do Senator Fischbach's bill first, and then we'll do my 899. Senator Fischbach.
Madam Chair, we have Senate File 940, and it's a fairly simple bill. What it would do is provide both at MNSCU, well, MNSCU must, and the U of M is suggested to do it or is encouraged to create a policy for veterans' preference for those graduate and professional programs that they offer. And I do have someone here who does have some information regarding that and would like to address the committee.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, my name is Gabriel Maravellis, and I would just like to take this opportunity to say thank you for your time. My purpose in coming here is to illuminate for the committee some of the difficulties facing veterans that may not be so apparent to all of you. I'll just start with my personal story with regard to my attempt to access higher education after a military experience. I was a member of Combined Joint Special Operations Task Force Afghanistan in a steer environment doing highly kinetic dynamic operations. So my purpose in saying that is to say that, suffice it to say, it was not a good study environment or an environment in which myself or the other members of that unit could prepare for follow-on education after the military. The deployments were extremely rapidly paced, often in austere environments, et cetera, et cetera. So my timeline was I got back from Afghanistan in August 2011, and I wanted to apply for graduate admission to the University of Minnesota for the academic year starting the next fall. The deadline for admission was 01 December. So the way the timeline worked out is I would have to take my GRE within 3 weeks of returning from Afghanistan from that kind of environment, which I just described. I consider myself academically capable. I'm sorry. It's ironic. I consider myself academically capable. I scored a 670-710, 4.5 in the GRE with coming from that kind of environment. My purpose in saying those scores is that I don't think every veteran has natural test-taking ability like that, and a lot of people want several months to study for the GRE. I think that students coming from a traditional academic environment probably prepare for the GRE for several months, if not half of a year or longer. So the issue was that I took the GRE as fast as possible, and you're kind of at the mercy of the company as to when you get your GRE scores back for admission. And the deadline was coming up, so I called the admissions department at the University of Minnesota related to the, it was a sociology graduate program. So I called their, I guess, their admissions specialist or however it was structured at the time. And I asked for a possible waiver or extension of the deadline, explained my situation, why my GRE score would not be back in time. And they were unwilling to offer an extension due to my special circumstances. Luckily, my score did come in 3 days before the 01 December deadline, so I was able to apply, although I was denied admission. Now, I'm just going to talk about a little bit maybe what they're looking for in the mission committee for graduate studies. I think they want to see things like fellowships, joint research, grants, internships, authorship of papers in academic journals. And veterans oftentimes have the opportunity to get their bachelor degrees while in the military, but they're not going to have the opportunity to get that kind of those kind of experiences that kind of really beef up your CV and make you a good candidate for graduate education. A lot of times they're going to sneak in that bachelor degree in between training, deployments, and things like that. And so they're not going to have that opportunity for fellowships, joint research, et cetera, et cetera. So the veteran CV will not compare to their academic competitors in that regard. But what have they done? Well, they've done real-world research on the ground whose results and reports are distributed to adjacent agencies and other government entities, which actually change policy and have real-world objective results. So the issue is that when you work for Combined Joint Special Operations Task Force, Afghanistan, doing cultural research, I was a cultural expert on Afghanistan. I speak Dari. Well, I can't exactly use those writing samples in my admissions packet because they're classified top secret. Yeah. As you know, for reasons which you can imagine. So that's just some of the special challenges that veterans have when they're applying for graduate education. It's the timeline of the military. So it really comes down to two things if you just want to kind of get like the nuts and bolts of it. One is the difficulty in explaining those academic experiences you have or the inability to use your academic background to show your ability to perform in a graduate program due to the nature of that academic background. The second would just be the difficulty of preparing for the entry tests and so on, or even the timelines of entry because of the nature of the military lifestyle. And this is an issue which unfortunately has not received a lot of publicity or study, despite the billions of dollars that society spends as a whole on veteran reintegration issues. Doing a quick search on the net, I looked into this stuff on Sunday. I could only find one study from a land-grant university looking into veteran reintegration, and it was not from Minnesota, it was from the University of Southern Florida. And said, the purpose of this project is to identify barriers that veterans face when they leave the military to attend college. This data, this says these data, but I think they meant this data, will enable USF, University of Southern Florida, to develop programs and services that will aid in the reintegration process for veterans attending USF. So my question is, the study is from 2011. Why did it take 10 years? We've been at war since 2001 for universities to start looking at their institutions as organizations which aid in the reintegration of veterans into society. And why has this not been done at the University of Minnesota? That's not really related to the bill. I just wanted to throw that in there because that's how I personally feel. All I could find from the U here is Karen Anderson, who's the assistant director of One Stop Student Services and University Veteran Services. 2011 issued a report, and her three main points were the transition from military to college can be overwhelming and deters many veterans from even starting, which relates to my story earlier. Assistance for veterans exists, but is not easily accessible and exists independently of one another. Campuses play an important role for veteran reintegration back into the community. So this is the U of M's own findings, that campuses play an important role for veteran reintegration. I can't substantiate that claim with research because there hasn't been any research on the role that universities play in reintegration. But I suspect that for many veterans, it is a very good pathway, especially if they've had traumatic combat exposure, a very good pathway for them to kind of slide back in you know, out of the military and into a productive life and healthy lifestyle. All right, so my last point, I know that you guys are all short on time. The committee's been going on for a while, so I have one last point. I think that there's a compact between veterans and society that needs to be addressed right now, and that compact has existed since World War II and even into World War I. It's, if you go fight for this country, you will be offered educational opportunities. And that has existed since the GI Bill of World War II, and there are similar programs going back even to the Civil War. So veterans have an expectation that when they come back from war zones, they will be able to use their GI Bill, which, because of the economic draft which exists, some veterans do join the military because they see it as their only pathway to a higher education. So there's sort of this, like, implicit deal that if you go to Iraq or Afghanistan, you can come back and you can go to college. Well, if universities aren't admitting veterans in the way that they should be, possibly because veterans are, as a population group, less likely to get into school because they've had less opportunity in the ways that I've described, you know, to make a good application, well, then how are they going to use their GI Bill? And I think society is kind of dropping the ball on that compact. That's the end of my testimony. If anyone has any questions, Madam Chair, I'd be very answer to happy them at this time.
Great job. You know, thank you for your service, first of all.
Thank you.
And, you know, we can't really begin to imagine what it really was like in the situations that you aptly and succinctly described. So it's always hard when we hear from our veterans, because I'm just always just overwhelmed with just appreciation and also the sadness that comes from knowing what effect it has on you and the families of those who serve. So, but also pride that we have those like you that do serve. So thank you. Senator Fischbach, I wondered, and I don't have the you know, all the language here, but it seems to me that a piece that would be missing is asking the universities of Minnesota and the colleges and universities to report back on how many veterans apply and how many they accepted or rejected, because I feel as though without some kind of a follow-up for accountability, that it will be pointing to a direction, but I'm not sure that we'll get exactly what we're looking for.
Madam Chair, I would be happy to have them report back. But I think you're referring to C, where it's the U of M colleges, private colleges and universities. I'm not 100% sure we can do that.
They could report back, though.
Okay. All right.
You know, Madam they could Chair, tell us how many applied and how many they accepted or rejected.
Madam Chair, I would be happy to do that. I would be interested in the information.
Yeah, I am too. I want to know. And then, you know, the other thing is I actually think even with state colleges and universities, because it says that it's a positive factor, but it doesn't tell them to accept them. So I still think it would be good for all the groups.
Well, and Madam Chair, my understanding is what it would do is, you know, as a positive factor, it would add points, so to speak, mm-hmm. so that you would, it's very similar to the employment preference that Minsky already has.
Gotcha. Senator Kent?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Fischbach, and Mr. Marvellis, thank you for your testimony, and you made a In telling your story, you gave me a thought that I would offer to Senator Fischbach as an idea for an additional point in here. And potentially it's some sort of requirement for the universities to have some sort of, you know, obvious access point for veterans to get the information that they need, because it sounds like one of the problems is that they can't even find how to get connected to, you know, to find out what the opportunities and the options and the programs are. I mean, I know when we went on our tour, we saw that beautiful office that was dedicated to right. our veterans. But, you know, that's a little unfortunate if the people who need that service can't find it. So I don't know if there's an opportunity there, but I would just, and I'd be happy to help.
And Madam Chair, Senator Kent, I know, actually, it just because I have it, I had a visit with MinSCU this morning, and they do have some positive things about being a military-friendly campus, and I know that many of their campuses have, or maybe all of them now, have veteran services offices on campus, and so they are doing a lot. I can't speak for the U of M because I didn't meet with them this morning, but this is fresh in my mind, okay. So they are doing a lot on the MinSCU campuses. Okay.
And it looks like a gentleman from MinSCU may want to say something, or?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Steve France. I'm the director of the Veterans Reentry Education Program for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. And I first want to join committee members and you, Madam Chair, in thanking you. Thanking you for your story and for your service today. We've been working for about 5 or 6 years on reintegration. We work closely with the National Guard. We've done a lot of veterans-friendly activities. Most recently, we were cited in February of 13 by the National Council for Adult and Experiential Learning on the work that we've done with a sidebar that featured three colleges or universities in the country, MinSCU being one of those systems of the three that were cited for supporting veterans in their activity. We're very pleased with this. We have our numbers of veterans have skyrocketed in the last 5 years, and we now have 10,644. We keep close track on that.
Great.
And that's increased by 54% in the last 5 years. So we do take this very seriously. It's a very serious issue, and frankly, I asked earlier this morning if it was any of our schools, because I haven't heard this concern issued. And when we checked with our deans of graduate school prior to this to see if this was a concern, they said, we are already implementing this.
Very good. Well, Senator Fischbach, if you wouldn't mind, we could move the bill to lay it over for possible inclusion, and then when the omnibus bill comes up, if we could have an amendment ready at that time to add the reporting for the University of Minnesota.
Certainly. I'll make that motion, Madam.
Okay. Oh, and I'm sorry, Senator Klassen.
Yes. Friendly amendment, Senator Fischbach. On line 1.8, could we add the word undergraduate? So we include undergraduate, graduate, or professional.
And Madam Chair, Senator Klassen, they're asking about the undergraduate and the MinSCU, and mm-hmm. We talked about that this morning, I thought maybe you would want to address that.
Madam Chair, Senator Klassen. Undergraduate is a little different than graduate. Obviously, they're very different, but in terms of admissions, they're very different. We have a statewide policy on undergraduate. Undergraduate for the colleges, for example, is completely open admissions. So there's not a need for preference because they're all welcome. It's open admission, and so that's a little different scenario than graduate, where it's very selective, and it's based on department requirements more than it is college or university or even system policy. And it's department selection based on the specifics of that department. So it gets to be a little bit different when we develop a policy. The policy that we have in place right now is undergraduate admissions, which is basically open, and then especially for colleges. And then for graduate, we leave that to the department to choose. So it complicates it a little bit to put that in.
Madam Chair?
Senator.
Just a comment. I have a nephew who was called up three times, once to Iraq, once to Afghanistan, and then once here in the United States to replace someone that was going overseas. It took him about 7 years to get his degree, and I was thinking of his situation where trying to be a little bit more helpful in dealing with his schedule and his needs. So that's what I was thinking. As an undergraduate, he faced some challenges just because of his military responsibilities.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Senator Klassen, there is a statute and a policy within MinSCU that protects soldiers and service members who are on deployment. We give them options for finishing their classes or their program or their degree. We make sure they're allowed to come back. We work closely with them, and we work with them sometimes while they're in country to finish the program or to finish the courses they're on. So, yes, we're very sensitive to that concern.
Okay. Very good.
Madam Chair, Senator Claussen, it may be something that you would want to add instead of under the MNSCU portion, under the U of M portion. Yes, it would be on 0.122. But if we're laying it over for possible inclusion, we can do something like that. I can take a look at it, but I did want to just point out the MNSCU issue with it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Fischbach?
I'll make the motion to lay it over for possible inclusion.
All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion
very much, and
passed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing us to go quickly.
Yep, very good. So we'll try and do 899 as quickly as possible. So, Senator Miller, we'll try and get to you today. But we're not on.
I'll be quick.
I know you will. I don't mind staying, but I don't know about you. We have the room till 6. Okay.
I can do mine first.
Yeah.
We're going to do our best.
I can.
You have a lever? Where's my hole? Just on the record, I had meant when President Kaler was here to bring up the tobacco-free issue at the university. Some students were here. Those students have now left. But members, I'm going to follow up with President Kaler in a letter. And I know Mr. Iverson is still here, so just want it set on the record that that was an oversight, and we apologize to those students, but we will follow up.
Senator Boniff, welcome to our committee, and I wanted to, for the record, this is not my purse underneath there, but I will guard it for you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
If you'd like to begin, please.
Yes. So, members, I have Senate File 899, which we did go through, but we've made some pretty substantial changes, so we actually have a delete all, but I won't go through the whole intent of the bill because we did that. So the purpose of reviewing this today is to review the fiscal note as well as the amendment. And so the delete all is the A3.
Motion to that effect?
Yeah, I'd like to, and this is an author's amendment, so I would move the A3.
All in favor, say aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you. So the first section has different words, but is essentially the same, and I'm going to leave that for now and let Ms. Wallstein come back to that. The second section on credential outcome reports, I'm going to let Inez speak about that briefly. Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. My name is Ines Wildwood, and I work for ALLETE, which is an energy company, doing business as Minnesota Power in Minnesota. I also am chair to the Governor's Workforce Development Council. I believe all of you last Tuesday, when I did not drive down, you received a copy of this report and recommendations from the Governor's Workforce Development Council. And just so that you know, the Governor's Workforce Development Council is a 32-member board appointed by the governor. We serve a federally mandated responsibility to be business-led as a council, and our mission is to analyze and recommend workforce development policies to the governor and to the legislature that help ensure that Minnesota has a globally competitive workforce. excuse me, my voice is going out. Our membership by state statute in Minnesota includes 6 business and industry members, 5 community-based organizations, 6 education representatives from all levels of education in Minnesota, 5 local government and state agency representatives, 6 organized labor, and 4 from the legislature. This report is, by statute, it's our responsibility to deliver on the 15th of January to you. And in our report this year, we made 4 recommendations, 3 of which are addressed in the legislation that you're looking at. The reasons, because I'm going to keep it brief and not go through all of my comments, but the obvious is, and you just heard a great example from a veteran, I've spent 15 years as a volunteer from business trying to understand the workforce development process in Minnesota, how the system works, you know, what the entrance and exit points are, how people navigate it. Our students are faced with that today, too, because we do not have the number of guidance counselors in our schools to help them navigate the system. Our 4 recommendations are around creating a process in Minnesota that's easier to identify where the jobs where I live might be, what the education is that I need to look at achieving in order to get into the jobs, and how do they match up in terms of geographically and where the schools are that might give me that education. That's it in a nutshell of what our concern is. In this report, you will also find a 1-page recommendation that our council has put forth as an easy way for job seekers as well as businesses to see what's happening and the schools that are there to provide post-secondary education to be able to see what's happening in their geographic area in terms of needs for employees and what the employers are looking for qualifications and where the schools are that offer them. And I'll take any questions that you have, but I'll stop there.
Thank you, Ms. Wildwood.
Thank you. You know, I'm going to have Ms. Wallstein just briefly go through the changes, and then I'd like to spend a couple minutes on the newest section of the bill. And actually, if they're not material, I don't think we need to go through them. Do you want to just briefly? Because I want to spend our time on the Workforce Center pilots.
Ms. Wallstein.
Hi, Amy Wallstein, Director of Education Workforce Development Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Section 1 is a technical amendment. Essentially, it cleans up the language from the previous draft. Deed helped us out with getting that streamlined. Section 2 addresses the concerns raised in testimony during the last hearing by Andrea Firstan from the United Way. And it calls for credential outcome reporting for workforce programs, and it aligns with one of the recommendations set forth in the Governor's Workforce Development Council report from January 2013. And it also does include data for those workforce programs on employment outcomes and trends by race and strategies to eliminate racial employment disparities, which goes to some of the concerns that were raised by Senator Torres Ray during the last hearing. There was no changes to Section 3 or Section 4, and then Section 5 does have the pilot program in it. So. And one other thing that I'll mention really quickly, we brought copies of the handout that is referenced in the book, The Skills Profiles, so perhaps the page could grab those so that the members can see what that is.
So now I'd like to ask my testifiers from the Workforce Center, some of who have traveled a long way, to come to the table, please. So while they're doing that, what we've added to the bill is something that Senator Torres Ray, I'm particularly excited about, and I'd like you to think about this for the future, those of you who are on education policy. When I first became higher ed chair, I had the occasion to make some remarks to the Workforce Center people, and they were from all over the state, and they'd come, and they were sharing really just their passion around connecting people with the right jobs, and you could just tell that this was a group of people who had a lot to offer. And I got this idea in the middle of my discussion with them, and I said, do you have the ability or the interest to go into our high schools and do workforce career counseling with our high school young people? And they got very excited about that. And they were like, yes, we could. And then come to find out it's actually happening, one of the places in our state. And so what this program does is it says we will have a pilot whereby there would be – it was three. Now we've added a fourth. Four different workforce centers would partner with a school district, and they would provide advising, workforce-related advising for the high school students. And so I'm joined by those who do represent these workforce centers, but we probably should start with the one who's actually doing it.
Absolutely.
Welcome to the committee, and if you could identify yourselves as you speak, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Ufford, and I'm the Executive Director of the Northeast Minnesota Office of Job Training. We're a partner in the Regional Workforce Center system among seven workforce centers there. And as Senator Bonhoff mentioned, we are in the halfway through the very first year of what we're calling Northeast Career Adventure, which is, in a very simple and quick nutshell, sharing the resources that are already available through the Workforce Center system with our local school districts. We are working with 33 different schools in our region, and we're providing services in two broad categories. One of them is services for the individual student, where we sit down with them one-on-one and go through career assessments, talk about post-secondary training options, job search for summer jobs, just a whole host of things that deal with transitioning out of high school and into the workforce. And then the second category of services is for classes or groups of students, and this is where we're bringing industry panels into the schools to talk about the needs of that industry in our region. We're bringing in speakers into the classroom to deliver any number of different types of curriculum along the lines of career exploration and career planning. But then the third component to this particular project that I think is rather unique is our effort to connect the business community with our public education system. We hear constantly from our constituents in the business community that they're very concerned about their future workforce, whether there'll be enough people that have the right skills or the right interests. And what we're trying to do is give those employers a chance to impact their future workforce by interacting with them directly, whether it be through job fairs, school-based career fairs. We've got an e-mentoring program. We're trying to develop an internship program throughout the entire region. And it's really been hugely well received by the schools. The Workforce Investment Board of the Northeast recently had a panel of educators in to talk a little bit more about what schools really need in terms of career planning and career guidance. And just to put this matter in perspective, Minnesota ranks third from the bottom in our country of the ratio of students to guidance counselors. It's something like 753 students to one. And you can imagine with all the mandates and testing and all the other things that these rare guidance counselors have to deal with, the last thing on their mind is working one-on-one with an average student about where they should go after high school. And our message to this program is not that everybody needs to graduate from high school and go get a bachelor's degree, but everybody does need to get some kind of training after high school. We work tremendously well with our local MNSCU institutions. We're very fortunate in our region to be under the auspices of the Northeast Higher Ed District, which is a collection of five community colleges in our region, and we've got excellent partnerships in place there. And so as we deliver these services to students, it's based on the partnerships that we've developed through the Workforce Center system. And I can tell you that the Workforce Center system is uniquely positioned to do this work. We've got connections with the business community, with economic development, with higher education, community-based organizations, juvenile justice, you name it, we've got those kinds of connections. And that is what we can bring to bear for the schools. And so I'm so pleased to be able to tell you that 6 months into this project, we've already served 2,300 students. And just to put that in a little bit of perspective, over the last 5 years, with the state and federal youth funding that we've received, we served over 1,300. We're already surpassed that in 6 months, and we're really just getting off the ground. There's a lot more work to be done. We believe that there are services that we can develop to engage parents in the career planning process. We know that kids do actually listen to their parents when it comes to suggestions for life after high school, but those parents don't necessarily understand what the economy has to offer their kids. And in many cases, we don't either, because it's evolving so much, and there's so many new jobs and new industries cropping up all the time. But I employ 28 career counselors. 12 of those are working with the schools with these 33 districts. These are trained, experienced professionals who have this expertise at their fingertips. The reason why we haven't been able to provide these services in the past is because our funding streams really pigeonhole us into serving very specific populations. And this particular grant that we're operating right now, which is a one-year grant from the state, we were able to start developing some of these resources, and I can tell you that it's just so warmly welcomed in our schools and the guidance counselors as well. We've made it very clear that we're not trying to take any guidance counselors' jobs, but we're trying to help them and supplement what they do and really bring what we do every day, every single day, to bear on the students who need it the most. And I'll leave it there.
Mr. Chair, question. So what is the grant that you have from the state and for how much?
It was a $135,000 grant. It was received through some temporary competitive youth funding that was released by the legislature last year. I believe it was funding that previously had been directly appropriated to some providers here in the metro to provide youth services. And there was a study done by the OLA that said maybe you should put it out for a competitive bid. And we threw our hat in the ring. This is work that I've wanted to do for a long time because, from my perspective, we're a publicly funded system. They're a publicly funded system. We need to be sharing these resources. The expertise is there. They need it. We just need to make the connection.
Very good. Yes. Either, whichever.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members, and Senator Bonnop. My name is Craig Nathan, and I represent Rural Minnesota Concentrated Employment Program. We're commonly known as Rural Minnesota SEP. And what I'd like to do is not repeat what Michelle talked about today, but provide some additional comments about the need for career exploration in the secondary schools, the high schools, and a little bit about why we feel that that is important. To continue, Rural Minnesota SEP is a nonprofit provider in the Workforce Center. We serve 19 counties. We operate 8 Workforce Centers, over 20,000 square miles in West Central and North Central Minnesota. Our mission is to strengthen the nation's workforce and economy by training and upskilling people for occupations in demand in this region. We provide a large range of programs designed to help people find jobs and keep jobs. Providing opportunities for individuals to attain job security and improve their way of life has been a consistent goal of Rural Minnesota SEP since its inception in 1968. During our vast history of working with employment and training services, we realized a key element to connect early with youth and offer services that we build, working on strong ethics and providing a meaningful and relevant career service through career advising. Rural Minnesota proposes to provide career advising, planning, and exploration to youth at the secondary level in the western part of the state, specifically Moorhead. This proposal is based upon past successful models operated in rural communities, most recently through a privately funded project in Brainerd, and it is one that I directly am involved in. This project will focus on demand occupations as identified by the GWDC for rural youth and providing effective career counseling, career exploration, college information, and labor market information, including how to locate and interpret data. By the time that youth leave secondary education, they will have participated in career exploration activities that are designed to help make career decisions regarding post-secondary training and employment. As schools face ever increasing budget cuts, it becomes difficult for smaller rural schools to provide thorough career counseling programs. This project is designed to fill this gap and provide career counseling and guidance to youth in a holistic manner to help increase the likelihood of self-sufficiency through making quality career choices. As has been indicated, that studies have shown that the knowledge of demand occupations in career counseling increases the likelihood of youth making sound career choices or well-informed choices regarding which post-secondary institution to attend. According to the Governor's Workforce Development Council, and this information is dated, but it is relevant, that Minnesota did rank 49th out of 50 in terms of ratio of students to counselors, and that was 800 to 1. We've improved a little bit since that time, but we're nowhere near where we should be. It's well known that high school counselors must focus on academics and issues of concern for today's youth and do not have the time to focus on career exploration among high school youth. Many youth graduate high school and are unprepared for the workforce or post-secondary choices. Providing career exploration in the secondary level helps youth prepare a mindful career plan and guides them to make solid choices for a career path. Next comes employers. Employers have overwhelmingly voiced a need for a well-trained workforce and many good-paying jobs, and career paths in the rural areas which are not being introduced in the career in the secondary or even post-secondary levels. Youth and families are simply not made aware of many of the good career paths available. Skipping down to a couple of these points, the last thing I'd like to say is that, you know, what we have found here is that by working through the Department of Employment and Economic Development, which is DEED, the Minnesota Department of Education, the Minnesota State College and Universities, and Rural Minnesota SEP, we've come together to break down institutional silos and provide a holistic approach to career planning at the secondary level. We can build strong rural workforce and provide meaningful career guidance to today's youth through pilot programs such as these. That concludes my report. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nathan.
Thank you very much. And then finally, Kathy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kathy Savala. I'm the Executive Director of Stearns Benton Employment and Training Council, and we, like these two other folks, are part of a system of workforce centers in the state of Minnesota. We serve the St. Cloud MSA. We had a pilot program that we operated actually from 2007 to 2011 in which we utilized our local resources of post-secondary students. They received credit, possibly a stipend, possibly financial aid, as we mobilized them to touch the post-secondary, or the, excuse me, the secondary students in some way regarding career exploration. Our youth council and our private sector-driven board decided that the complexity of the system prohibited really using the interns in the way that we had, and that rather than those individuals being the primary ambassadors into the high schools in our region, we have 13 districts, they required additional leadership. We had just reached that decision when we lost the funding. So passion is still there, need is still there, and there's an opportunity in our region. In each of our regions, we have maximized the resources that are distinctive in our respective regions. We all have certain chambers. We all have certain employer champions. We all have certain educational champions with which we work in our regions, and we tailor our responses to our respective regions. In ours, there was a community priorities session in February that identified this particular topic as a priority for our community. There's an initiative in the St. Cloud District called Partners for Student Success. The St. Cloud District has developed a single database in which student information is kept. Partners are going to be able to download information in that about activity. Benchmarks are being set in terms of the career exploration activities that they wish to offer all students, so we are able to measure progress. What we lack are resources. The passion's there, the commitment's there, and the partnership is there. The money isn't. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, this A3 has not gone through the formal fiscal note process. We did get a fiscal note for the bill as originally looked at. So it seems to me that given that this is not going to be carried, the fiscal part is not going to be carried in our committee. It's going to move on to Senator Tomasoni's. First, we go to Senator Sparks and then to Senator Tomasoni's, that rather than waste the committee time going over a fiscal note that isn't the final fiscal note, that we just deal with, if members are comfortable with the bill, that we just move it to the policy committee of Senator Sparks.
Very good. Questions by the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoff, just out of curiosity, what did that come the fiscal note come in at? I guess I didn't see a fiscal note in the packet, and were there significant enough changes that it would have affected the fiscal
note? Mr. Chair and Senator Fischbach, unfortunately, the pilot project wasn't in the bill, so I never did get the fiscal note for the pilot project. The rest of the fiscal note came in my opinion, ridiculously high. It came in at $1 million, and I would like to spend the time with the department before it gets to Senator Tomasoni's committee, understanding and discussing that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonner, thank you very much. And actually, I guess there was one, but I didn't see it. So,
well, it didn't have Section 5 with
it. But it did have – it was a preliminary, though.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Yes. Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Bonhoff, I agree. I have concerns about the fiscal note. I don't know. Even though we're not carrying it here, it might be a good idea for us to bring it back. The cost and the number of FTEs are a bit concerning to me. So I think we should continue that conversation if we can.
Senator Miller, I welcome you to join me in those conversations with the department because, as I understand it, the House that's moving this forward is approaching it differently as well with regard to the fiscal note because it doesn't seem as though what we're doing should be that expensive.
Very good. Mr. Chair and Senator Bonhoff, I'd be happy to be involved in those conversations.
Thank you.
Good. Other comments?
And it should be said, DEED has been very, very helpful. There is some concern around section number 2, whether or not that might, in fact, be duplicative with what DEED is already doing. And so we'll continue to have that conversation.
I appreciate you being here and offering your testimony as a former suburban high school principal. I'm well aware of the problems that we have with the guidance council student ratio. And you've pointed that out. Curious, do you use the Minnesota Careers, booklet? That's a great publication. I'm glad to hear you're using that. I know it's something we've used in our district, and every student gets a copy of that. And it's very good. And I also like that your partnership with the schools, the workforce centers, but also the businesses out in the greater Minnesota area and in the Twin City area. I think that's a great partnership, and we should see some really positive results. Thank you. Yes.
And thank you,
Senator
Mr. Chair.
Egan.
Thank you. And I just wanted to make a comment, too, on the fiscal note. Of course, I'm concerned, too, to make sure that the funding is going to be there. But I think it's important to note the cost savings of this initiative as well. And this pilot project it's already been demonstrated to have worked in one area and been very effective at connecting students to businesses and to getting them on the right career path. And it's so important to keep them from drifting. And that's wasting a lot of money, not just for the students, but for our state taxpayers as well. We want to make sure these dollars are being spent effectively. And I think this is a project that will go a long way towards meeting that goal. And I wish it was statewide, but that would carry a much bigger fiscal note. And that's probably the only reason why it's not being done statewide is just because of the initial cost. But sometimes you got to spend something to get something. And I think this is a perfect example of that. So
well,
thank
Mr.
you for bringing
Chair,
it forward.
Yeah, and Senator Eakin, I could use all the help from members around this committee to lobby Senator Tomasoni for the importance of this. So. Thank you.
Very good. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Bonhoff, you and I have had some conversations offline about this. I think this is so wonderful, and I congratulate you all for what you're doing because it's such a huge contribution. I just want to add one little fact to the conversation about the lack of counselors in our high schools. We're at about 750 students per counselor, and the recommended national level would be 250, so that we're three times where we should be. And so it really is an incredible resource. One question that I would appreciate if any of you might be able to address in just in the spirit of sort of due diligence, the workforce centers usually work with adults, and the question of now working with minors. Are there any concerns, any anecdotes, any reassurances on this subject, that I would just – anything you can offer on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kent, I'd just like to actually note that serving youth has been one of our populations for decades, but it's that very, very specific at-risk population that we've been limited to because of our funding. So we do have extraordinary amounts of experience dealing with kids and with students and with the issues that they face. What this will allow us to do is apply that expertise to the whole bunch of students who need it.
Great. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kent, in the pilots that I'm doing, I do it a little bit different. I go directly into the high schools with my counselors, and they work hand-in-hand with the guidance counselors. And so, we meet the students at the door, so to speak, because really that's where they live.
That's great.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Senator
We actually work with youth age 14 on up.
Okay.
And we all do, the whole system statewide does.
Thank you.
Good.
Just another comment. At one time, we did have a career education component. And unfortunately, that's gone by the wayside as we've looked at additional testing and standards. And I know in many school districts, we do not offer a course in career education. And therefore, it's even put more pressure on our counseling staff, which we've just identified as not adequate. So,
well, if I could entertain, I would move that Senate File 899, as amended, be passed and referred to the Committee on Jobs. Senator Sparks, your whole committee.
It's been moved that Senate File 899 be re-referred to the Jobs, Agriculture, and Rural Development Committee as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Get to hit the
Senator
gavel.
Miller, we'll do yours fast.
I'll be quick.
Thank you guys so much.
In the pilot project.
Well, thanks for the reminder about as amended. I forgot about that.
Senator Miller's been so patient. We've got Senate File 548 before us.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'd like to move. No, I'm just kidding. Senate File 548 is the bill pertaining to MOOCs, and we were so fortunate to have a great presentation by Dr. Kohler about MOOCs, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. We did discuss the bill. I will mention to the committee that it's a work in progress, and I'm committed to continuing to work with the folks at the Office of Higher Education, EdX, Coursera, and everybody else involved. We want to make sure that we get this right. I've been told that we're one of the first states that's leading the charge on this, so we can be a model for the rest of the country. And frankly, I want to make sure that that we do it right. So we're going to continue those conversations. Basically, the bill allows free educational courses in the form free online education courses to be offered in the state of Minnesota. Under current law, technically, it is illegal for Minnesotans to participate in these courses that are being offered. And I'm not sure if there's anyone that wants to testify, but again, it's a work in progress, and we're going to continue the work on this legislation to make sure that we get it right.
Senator Fischbach.
Madam Chair and Senator Miller, this may be bigger than your bill, but I was curious, that we don't have Senator Mr. Pogemiller, what is he now?
Director.
He's director.
Okay, I was going to call him senator or something or all kinds of other things. But it may be bigger than that, but I'm just curious. Okay, so under this, they should have been being charged a fee then. Or excuse me, without this bill, they should have been under current law.
Correct.
Madam Chair,
and we do have
Senator, and we do
have Ms. Grimes here from the Office of Higher Ed that would be happy to answer any questions.
Sorry,
But the answer to your question, Senator Fischbach, is yes.
And then I guess maybe Ms. Grimes, you want to rethink coming up to this table after I say that. But Madam Chair, I was just curious under what authority the Office of Higher Ed decided not to charge that fee, and how they did that.
Madam Chair, Senator Fishback, I think I will let the Office of Higher Ed answer that question.
And Madam Chair, I provided fair warning for the Office of Higher Ed. What
Ms. Grimes.
Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. Our consumer protection statutes are the regulatory statutes, and they were adopted many years ago, more than 20 years ago, with the idea of protecting students, and everyone assumed at the time that students would be charged money. The whole idea that there would be completely online organizations and courses offering free massive courses just was not considered at the time that the statutes were adopted. Technically speaking, any institution that offers instruction to Minnesota residents must come through the Office of Higher Education and either be registered or licensed with us. Registered in the cases of degree-granting institutions, licensed in the case of non-degree-granting institutions that offer certificates and things less than an associate degree. The office made a decision that preventing students from taking free classes was something that perhaps we could prevent while we worked on legislation that would make it make more sense.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Fishback and Ms. Grimes, not trying to be a problem, you just decided not to enforce it.
Yes.
Is that, Madam Chair, Ms. Grimes, is that generally what the Office of Higher Ed does?
Madam Senator Chair, Fishback. Senator, that is quite unusual.
Okay.
Senator Fishback, I think hence they notified us. But I hear you.
But Madam Chair, I can notify you. I'm not going to enforce the law. I mean, it just it seems kind of not good. But and I understand the reason for the bill. So, but I was just that was something that was nagging at me after Director Pogemiller was here one day when he said, well, we just decided not to charge it. And it's been kind of bothering me because it does set a precedent that we're just going to have things, because they don't fit into what we have now, we're just not going to enforce certain laws.
And Madam Chair and Senator Fishback, I remember when this topic was in the news and it sparked a lot of controversy on both sides, and I do share your concerns, and that's why we're coming forward with this legislation, because we want to make it right, and at the same time we want to make sure that Minnesota students, actually Minnesota citizens, because it's not just college students, that all Minnesotans have the opportunity to take these free online educational courses. So I can't help what happened in the past, but we're going to move forward with some good model legislation for the country to take a look at.
And Madam Chair, Senator Miller, Fishback. My issue is not with the courses. My issue is with
we have
statute in place, and it's just kind of, well, that doesn't fit right now, so we're not going to pay attention.
Senator Sharon,
just to follow up on that, I understand what Senator Fishback is saying. So in this instance, I'm not talking about this bill now. We're talking about the earlier decision for a free course to not make it unavailable because you have to apply a policy. Is there something that we should be doing in law? Because these kinds of things might come up periodically. Sometimes we have in our law that you can make independent decisions if you need to up to $150,000, you know, to a CEO or something like that, or up to $500,000, where you get caught between legislative sessions and you need to make decisions that will make something possible that the expectation simply doesn't fit the circumstances. Is there something that we should be writing to make certain that the issue, because I agree with Senator Fishback, you know, we ought to articulate what it is that we're comfortable with legislatively in terms of the flexibility of decision-making around unique situations. We should try to articulate what's the circumstances under which that can occur, as long as it comes back for confirmation or affirmation in the legislature within a certain period of time. I think that's a good point, and I would ask if you would take that back, and maybe we can amend this bill with some specific language that relates at some point as it moves along to that problem.
Madam Chair, I think that's a very interesting suggestion, and I would just reinforce, we did seek legislation at the earliest opportunity after the event.
Thank you. Senator Kent.
And I would just add, thank you, Madam Chair, that in a couple days, I believe, it had to go through Judiciary last night, we will have the Office of Higher Education agency bill that also addresses this. And so my question was, I'm assuming we will be holding this over and we would have an opportunity to sort of make sure everything's very consistent, because they did bring this up in this agency bill for this exact reason.
And well, members, Senator Sharon.
Wanting to get this language passed because it's not been authorized. But the other question that is related to Senator Fishbach, it's a critical question. It's not related to this bill, mm-hmm. except that it emerges because a decision was made without legislative authorization that we all get. Makes sense. So it tells us that there's something that we need to articulate that gives the director of this commission or whatever we call it, a department. Is there a way we can articulate in law some flexibility around certain decision making with a time frame for review and confirmation by the Senate?
To that same point, though, Senator Sharon, one of the things that has bothered me since I've been here is that we sometimes pass laws that aren't implemented and they're not followed. And mm-hmm. if you follow up on it, and they'll, you know, the answer will be, well, we learned that it wasn't possible. Well, nobody ever comes back and says it's not possible. We're not doing this. And so there is a feedback loop. Oh, I'd be glad to tell you about that.
Well, I think that's then we ought to be taking this up. I don't know if this comes up, but that's not okay.
I agree, so. Senator Huck Sharon.
Is absolutely right.
I agree.
This.
So I think we should take up this point. Very good.
No consequences.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move Senate File 548 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion's adopted. And it should also be said that the folks from edX who are from Harvard and MIT who also have their own company that puts on MOOCs did come the day we did the health exchange bill, and they flew here. They spent their whole day here. We ended up doing a video of them. Our CA, Mr. Karnecki, was very creative, along with our other staff, and so we will send that video out to members. Okay.
All right, Madam Chair and members of the committee, Senate File 1045 is a bill that we're bringing forward. It really gets at the heart of a lot of conversation that we've had around this table in this particular committee about financial strategies to assist higher education students to timely complete their programs of study. We've heard several concerns that, number one, they're either not completing them, or number two, we've heard the term picked off, where students are being literally picked off before they graduate. So the idea of this legislation is just to have the conversation about how can we encourage students to complete their programs of study, whether it's a certificate or a two-year associate's degree or a bachelor's degree. And there are a number of different criteria laid out here: tuition policies, financial aid policies, a system for identifying counseling and assisting students who are near completion but are considering leaving a program due to financial reasons, or a strategy to connect students to employers prior to the completion of a program, and combining work experience with program completion. So what this legislation would do is authorize the Office of Higher Education to bring the right people together and have a study and take a look at these strategies, and then bring that back to the committee for us to review.
Senator Miller.
Madam Chair and members, I would like to move
Senator Miller. No,
oh,
I have
I'm
something.
Sorry. Oh.
Would you look at line 1.19?
Oh, you're ready to move it, Madam
no,
Chair.
No, not quite yet. 1.19 and 1.20.
Okay.
Look at those two lines. I would ask if you would be willing to strike our near completion of a program so that instead it would say a system for identifying, counseling, and assisting students who are considering leaving a program due to financial reasons?
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to do that.
So I would move that we strike our near completion of a program, but all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Now go ahead, Senator Miller.
All right, Madam Chair and members, I'd like to move Senate File 1045 to be laid over for possible
inclusion. As amended?
As amended, for possible inclusion in the Higher Education and Workforce Development Omnibus Bill.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion's adopted.
Right.
Well, I just want to point out that we actually, if you look at what time we started, we did our committee time exactly. So,
but Madam Chair, then, those of us who are here on time put in extra hours, correct?
We did, didn't we?
Yes.
So yes, we did.
All those who were here should get an extra can.
Committee on Workforce Higher Development